Water is essential to life, but also agriculture, industry, and energy. It is the foundation of modern civilization, but ever-rising consumption and climate change have many worried there won't be enough to go around. Meanwhile, sea level rise and extreme weather threaten some areas with disaster. How can we avoid conflict and build peace? How can we ensure everyone has what they need to survive and thrive as we march toward a global population of more than 9 billion? You're listening to Friday Podcasts from the Environmental Change and Security Program at the Wilson Center. In this special series, Water Stories, produced with support from USAID, we interview experts and practitioners from around the world to hear how people are thinking about and addressing water, peace, and conflict challenges. Today's podcast features Ken Konka, a professor with the American University's School of International Service, speaking at an October 2016 Wilson Center event.
When we start talking about water in the context of security, we're immediately drawn to a conversation about conflict. And that's often framed in terms of scarcity of water and a real zero-sum game around water, where scarcity begets grievances, which beget instability and conflict. And certainly, I think that's part of the story. But when we step back, I think the larger frame is really one of uncertainty and of managing risks. And in that context, I think the good news is that there are a lot of cooperative opportunities. There are severe barriers to tapping them, but certainly we have to try. So I'll answer your question on two different levels. First, I'll say a little bit about at the interstate level in terms of shared river basins and international law and institution building, where there's a lot of work to be done and a lot of opportunity to do it. And then second, I'll step down to the level where people live in terms of public health and livelihoods and the sustainable development agenda, where, again, I think there are a lot of opportunities that we can tap. There are 276 internationally shared water courses in the world. Fewer than half of them have any kind of an international accord, a treaty, some sort of a legal arrangement. Fewer than a quarter of them have an accord that involves all of the riparian nations in the basin. So we have a very weakly developed and patchwork body of international law. When you look at the content of that international law, we find that most of those agreements are actually fairly static, inflexible, water-sharing agreements. I get this much, and you get the rest. Or I get this much at this point, and you get what's left over, and so on. And they're really not the sort of dynamic institutions that we need to actually manage the problem. So we need to think less about allocating a fixed pie of water and more about sort of expanding that pie through sensible and cooperative management. The UN Watercourses Convention, which is a framework treaty that basically suggests the sorts of principles that countries should embed when they negotiate basin-level agreements, environmental protection, avoiding significant harm to other basin states, sharing water equitably, sharing information, prior notification of planned infrastructure projects in the basin, and so on and so forth. On one level, it provides a very good framework. It was really written in the pre-climate change era, and I think it doesn't deal with a lot of the challenges of adaptation and resilience that we face. So the challenge in international water law is really to create more flexible accords first that do a much better job of mobilizing, monitoring, and sharing information. When India and Bangladesh signed the Ganges River Accord in the mid-1990s, which was a significant accomplishment to do that, they basically created a water allocation scheme that created fictional water, because that was the only way that they could get an agreement. And so they used a couple of the highest flow years of the preceding century in order to say how much water each country would get, and then they signed the treaty. And that's clearly not the kind of flexible agreement that monitors and adapts, and how will we deal with the drought years? How will we deal with sustained drought and extremes that become the new normal? So there's a lot of work to be done there. Second important element is better impact assessment for planned projects and for planned uses of the water. Information in this space is often treated as a national security asset and is not shared by countries, and that can lead to a lot of charges and allegations about what various countries are doing. Fortunately, in a world of Google and crowdsourcing and all these other wonderful things that we're seeing, that's a position that's getting increasingly difficult to sustain. A few years back when Lao PDR was proposing building the Xiaoburi Dam on the Mekong, they did an environmental impact assessment and a cost-benefit study. It was done late, and it wasn't done well, but the initial picture that it drew was that Lao would benefit substantially from this dam, largely through electricity sales, and that the impact on the other countries in the basin would be minimal. What that impact assessment did not account for was the downstream value of artisanal fishing, which was something that previously none of the governments really had any clue about how dependent downstream populations were on fisheries for their health, for their well-being, and for their livelihoods. So the Mekong River Commission did a study that completely stood that cost-benefit analysis on its head by costing out, in very real dollar terms, the value of artisanal fishing and the ecosystem services that sustain it. It was not enough to prevent the dam project, but it is the sort of analysis that we need to start moving toward much more systematically and building into our treaties and our institution-building arrangements those kinds of provisions. Pre-positioning dispute resolution arrangements. We know that conflicts are coming, not necessarily in the sense of violent conflict, but certainly in the sense of contentious disputes that can disrupt progress, that can disrupt joint projects, that can disrupt building smart infrastructure, and so on. And so building greater dispute resolution mechanisms. And also adapting our funding streams to these kinds of more dynamic and forward-looking institutional arrangements. The World Bank has a practice of not being willing to lend money for a significant infrastructure project in a basin unless there's an accord in place. And that's a very, very good policy to have. Unfortunately, we sometimes tend to tally success as the getting of an accord so that we can then liberate the funding. And I think we need to start being a little more, you know, it's the content of the accords that funding needs to be a little bit more contingent on. And then the last thing I'll say about the shared river basins is there are tools that have been created by the Paris Accord and the new approach to the climate regime that need to be mobilized in this space. We need to start doing the kinds of climate vulnerability assessments that the Paris Accords envision at the basin level. We need to start using the national adaptation programs. There was an audit done of the first wave of national adaptation programs. Not one of them deals with the question of shared watercourses. They're very much little national scale footprints that don't look at the dynamic flows across borders, and it's critically important that we start doing that sort of analysis. The second, and I'll be very brief because I know we're pressed for time. The second place where I think there's enormous cooperative potential is in the Sustainable Development Goals, which sometimes don't get the attention here in Washington that they need to. We really need to understand that for most countries in the world, this is the development planning tool. This is the way in which countries are positioning their commitments, their funding, their legal reforms for the next 15 years. And it's critically important that we recognize the opportunities that are created by that. The water goal, goal 6 in the SDGs, is actually quite good. I wish that it had acknowledged the human right to water, which it failed to do, because that was a very contentious thing to do. But whereas the old Millennium Development Goal on water said, let's reduce by half the water poverty on the planet, the proportion of people who don't have access to safe drinking water and who don't have access to sanitation. This goal says, let's eliminate water poverty entirely in the period of the SDGs, and let's do it with a much closer eye to ecosystem services that provide the water quality that we need and in an equitable manner that doesn't leave anybody behind. So the way the goal is framed is very, very good. The problem, I think, with the way the SDGs have rolled out thus far is that they don't take a sufficiently rights-based approach. There are a lot of people on the planet for whom community-based natural resource management, when it's done right, is the most real and vivid experience of democracy that they have in their lives. And that's strengthening that is an enormous opportunity to get back to the real underpinnings of U.S. national security, which in my mind are always going to be democracy and prosperity for people. And so working with the water goal of the SDGs as a leverage point, Whether we're talking about livelihoods, whether we're talking about gender equity, whether we're talking about public health, water is one of the real fulcrums for multiple gains across the multiple goals. But to do it in a much more rights-based and participatory sort of a manner, to collect data that allows us to see who is winning and who is losing as we begin to implement some of the funding streams, some of the infrastructure projects is particularly important. And a last point that I'll make, which may sound like a little bit of a stretch on a panel about U.S. national security, but I don't think it's a stretch at all, is it's critically important that we extend robust human rights protections to people who are advocating for this sort of an approach. There's research that shows that the number of environmental advocates that have been assassinated in the last decade rivals the number of international journalists who have died directly in the line of duty. And we know that that is not a small number of people. And so if we are going to do something in a way that leaves nobody behind and really gets down to that livelihood level, it seems to me critically important that we sort of defend the defenders of that approach in a very real way.
You've been listening to Friday Podcasts from the Wilson Center. Thanks for tuning in. For more information, follow us on Twitter @NewSecurityBeat and visit our website, newsecuritybeat.org.